Welcome to another segment of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and today's special guest is the longest running headliner and best female impersonator in Las Vegas. He has completed over 25,000 performances, entertained for 10 million people, and gone through over 350,000 costume changes. He has also been honored with 2 stars on the Las Vegas Walk of Stars. Please welcome Frank Marino. So everybody knows that you've made a career for the last 35 plus years in Vegas, but let's talk about where you started. You're from Las Vegas, from Las Vegas. You're from Long Island, right?
Yes, I'm from Oceanside, Long Island.
Okay. Now, what was it like as a teenager in Long Island? Did you know you were gay then? Did you have any issues with that?
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I knew from whenever I could remember knowing things that I was gay. I get really like taken back when people say I didn't know. I don't know how confusing it could be, but I knew I was gay, and I knew not everybody was gay and it was shunned upon, but I was really never the type of person to not do something because somebody else wasn't going to like it. So I was like, this is me. And if people threw like religious stuff at me because of it, I was like, whoever is the real God, okay, whether it's Buddha or Jesus or whatever, that person, when they made me gay. So deal with it.
All right, then. What kind of a student were you? Were you the class clown? Were you flamboyant? Who were you?
I was the quiet one on the side. So again, I was in Long Island, but we would always go into Brooklyn, into Manhattan, where it was really more happening. And at the time when I was a teenager, it was like disco was very big. And on Long Island, everybody liked rock music, and it was disco was dead and all that stuff. They hated disco. So I was more of the John Travolta looking, like I'd wear the disco shirts and the dress pants, and the other guys in my class would be like the ripped jeans and the rock and roll t-shirts. So I never had many friends. I wasn't flamboyant, but I did dress nice. And I definitely wasn't the class clown, although in my head I was thinking things that would have been very funny had I said them.
So you mentioned going to New York to party, and I know that you've experienced some of the iconic nightclubs in New York. You've been to Studio 54 and Limelight, correct? What was that like?
It was great. I mean, to be in that scene at that time, I was very young. Don't forget, at that time, you only had to be 19 to get into the nightclub. So I went to Studio 54. I performed at Studio 54. I performed at the Red Parrot. I performed at the Electric Circus. I performed at Limelight. Trying to think, most of the big clubs in Manhattan, but what I really enjoyed, to be honest with you, was the Long Island clubs. And to tell you the truth, I don't think there's many left at all, if any at all, on Long Island. So I really cherish those days because I had a blast performing and hanging out in the gay clubs on Long Island.
And then, as I understand it, after you've partied a little bit in New York and kind of, you know, experience the gay life there. Is that about the time frame where you were kind of whisked away to Las Vegas and started your mainstream performing career?
Yeah, I'm going to say that I did the nightclub scene for like 2 years. And that's how I learned everything about the art form of drag and how tough of a business it was. And then my next step was going to Atlantic City. I met Joan Rivers, and this was like a year, like my first year into it, and then I had another year that I still performed. But I remember going to Atlantic City, meeting Joan Rivers in a casino, and she was very nice, let me come backstage, and I took a photograph with her. And this photograph ended up molding my whole career. Because every time a gay bar would hire me, and I had a picture of me and Joan Rivers, they were like, oh my God, he knows Joan Rivers. But I used that photograph to just climb that step of success. And I'll tell you, the ladder of success is much harder to do when you're wearing high heels. So it was a hard road to get up there. And that photo carried me and I'll never forget it. That same day that Joan Rivers had me come backstage and allowed me to see her, there were producers from a show in Atlantic City called An Evening at Lacage. And there was another Joan Rivers impersonator. I was dressed as myself, but he was as Joan Rivers. And they were introducing him to her as well. And she said to me, they're opening a show and the Joan Rivers character is going to be the MC of the show. You should speak to them. And I did. They auditioned me the next day in Atlantic City with no makeup at all, just as myself. And I got a job. I went directly from Long Island when I got home to Beverly Hills and auditioned for them. That's where the main La Caja Falls office was on La Cienega Boulevard. Did the audition for them, got the job. They took me to Florida for 6 months. And then we went home for three to regroup. And then I came to Las Vegas. I think it's like 37 years ago now. And the rest is history. I've been here ever since.
Now, you mentioned that you were in Florida for 6 months. And I know back around that time frame, there were some clubs that, to Floridians particularly, but to a lot of people on the in the U.S., were kind of iconic. And yes, they included the Copa and the Marlin Beach in Fort Lauderdale, El Goya and Trax in Tampa. Did you ever perform at any of those or hang out at any?
I performed at Marlin Beach and I performed at the Copacabana a lot. Because when I went to Florida to do An Evening at Lacage, that was in Lauderhill, which is right there. And it was a it was like a 5,000 seat stadium. And on the side, it had a nightclub room that we played. It held like 1,000 people. So we would perform there every night. And then we would do our late night shows, you know, like they do these shows at like midnight. We would do our shows like at the Copa and the Marlins, stuff like that. So I really remember that just being such a great and happy time.
Yeah. And it was a completely different environment then.
Completely.
I had started going out to clubs a couple of years before you did. And places like the Marlin Beach and the Copa, they were just safe havens. You walked in there and you felt like you were at home because you could be yourself. You didn't have to hide from, you know, the people that you worked with if you were in a mainstream employment, from your neighbors, from anybody, and pretend that you weren't gay because it wasn't cool to be gay back then.
Right.
And they just kind of embraced you and you felt welcome. And people like yourself who came in and performed there, particularly the people who had the more polished shows, mm-hmm. They kind of gave you an extra sense of value because
they put you on a pedestal. I will say that they put the drag queens on a pedestal,
especially the ones that went all out.
Yes. Know? And there were a lot that went all out. I'm saying outside of even the Lacage shows and the Diva shows and Legend shows, these impersonators or whatever they want to be called, drag queens impersonators, were amazing. It was the lip sync, the makeup, the costuming. I mean, I remember the first time I saw a drag queen was on Fire Island. Could you imagine? And I love Diana Ross. Love Diana Ross. And I love Cher. And there was Chaz was doing Cher, I think the name was. And somebody else was doing Diana Ross. And I was like in heaven. This is the first time I saw a drag queen. And I saw the show at the Ice Palace. So when I did perform there a couple of years later, it was really like a dream come true.
And then after your Florida gig, basically you ended up on the West Coast. You were in Vegas and, you know, I'm sure you made little side junkets to Los Angeles and explored the scene there as well. How did that experience in the gay bar scene, especially since so much of it revolved around you being a celebrity in the gay bar scene, how did that mold not only your personality, but your career?
Well, it molded it greatly because it toughens you up, because even though we were put on pedestals, like I said, and it looked very glamorous to everybody in the audience, and they were such supportive people, you know, they would tip you and everything. So supportive that, like you said, it just made you feel welcome and made you feel good. And behind the scenes, we were still getting ready in the basements, you know, right? In the kitchens, if they had a restaurant attached to it. So it was like a tough atmosphere. You know, I've actually seen rats run across my shoes, like in these places. And for that reason, I'm glad it was only 2 years, but it was amazing 2 years of doing these different cities. You know, being in New York, you have the tri-state area. So I had New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, all those gay bars. And I was very lucky also, I had a manager. So he would call up and get the bookings. And then he started calling the straight clubs. And I got a gig at a club called Escapes. And they did a strip show there as well. And when I was telling you this in the pre-interview, I have a poster with me in Escapes, my friend Pamela Stanley, who's a disco singer. She's a singer. She sings Coming Out of Hiding. And Madonna on the same roster. So I was there 1 week. She was there another week. And Madonna. And I always tease now with Pamela Stanley going, I guess she just made better choices than we did. But, you know, great for her.
So you get to Vegas and you were brought there by Lacage, correct? Is that where you started in Vegas?
Yes. So what happened was, so we did the show in Florida for Lacage. They had the show in Atlantic City where they had that gentleman doing Joan Rivers. Then we went to Florida and I did Joan Rivers. Then the show closed in Florida because it's seasonal. And we came to Las Vegas, which was my dream. I used to visit here on vacation, but I loved it so much. I wanted to live here. So when I got the show in Vegas, I was like in heaven. So to be here and then become somebody in the community on top of it was like a dream comes true. So that point, I went to an evening at Lacage. That was at the Riviera Hotel for almost 25 years. Then I did my own show, and it was Divas Las Vegas for almost 10 years. And now I'm the star of a show called Legends in Concert at the Tropicana. And that's been 2 years, if you count COVID.
Right. We all had a little break in there.
Yeah. I always thought I wanted a staycation as a reward for working so hard. And I've changed my mind since then.
Well, I was having a conversation the other day with another illusionist impersonator that I'm sure you're familiar with, who has also worked in Vegas and Atlantic City and several other places, Jimmy James.
Yes.
And Jimmy, this is an exact quote from what Jimmy said, and then I'll let you answer it. He said, quote, I totally admire Frank surviving in Las Vegas for some 30 years. How did he pull that off? I found Vegas to be more treacherous than Hollywood. How did you do it?
It is. It's getting harder and harder every day. I'm so glad I did my stuff in my heyday 30 years ago, because it is so difficult right now to open a show. I came at the end of the mafia era, and you would do a show and they would throw money at you. Even the gay bars would throw money at you. And then they started becoming more and more corporate America, and they wanted more money for I'm making it up, but whatever money's come in, they wanted money for the space, like a rent. They wanted money. If you had billboards or posters up in the hotel, they wanted a part of the show. It was crazy. When I first got here, they paid for everything and we got a crazy salary. It then reversed. And now it's really hard to do certain things because they don't want to pay you to do it. And I'm at the point where if I'm not going to do it just to do it, unless I'm going to enjoy it, then of course I would do it. Or if it was for a charity or something, I would do it. But I'm not just going to work in a hotel, say I'm working in a hotel. So if somebody's starting here now, it would be very hard. But Jimmy's right. It was a game. And you had to play it like a very strategic chessboard and make the move and call people's bluffs and be willing to lose everything if you didn't win. So you had to have enough confidence yourself that you would be the best at what you did, so that you wouldn't get let go. And I, after a point, had that confidence and just had the attitude, if you can find somebody better, then let them do it for less, but I'm not.
He also mentioned that he has seen your show away from Vegas at other casinos, and that it was equally as spectacular as it is in Vegas. And he asked, how does he maintain quality control with a huge company like that?
It's a lot of not sleeping. It's a lot. It was very difficult. When I had my Diva show, and let me just say, this is why Jimmy James has survived so long. He is the nicest, most complimentary, most talented sweetheart that I know. this boy, everybody loves. Nobody will ever say, I don't like Jimmy James. He is such a nice person. And he has given me that same compliment. And I know one of the shows he saw on the road, I remember it. And he said the same compliment to me of how do you do it? It was so great. It's because I want to make sure everything's perfect. And making sure everything's perfect is going to have people say, you're a bitch, or who do you think you are, whatever. I don't think I'm anybody, and I will work just as hard as anybody else, but I want it done. I want it done right. If it's not going to be done right, we're not going to do it. So having that attitude, maybe that comes from liking Diana Ross, I don't know. But having that attitude to make everything go your way paid off for everybody. So I wanted it perfect. They did it perfect. And everybody loved them for being perfect. So I would do my show and literally stand on the side, because I would come in and out in between each act. I was like the silver thread to tie it together. And I would watch every act because they were all individually so good that I could literally watch my own show night after night after night and see how good they were. And I made sure I let them know how good they were. And I just loved every minute of that.
Now, were you always a perfectionist in your performance from day one? Was that always an integral part of you getting up on stage and doing whatever act it was that you were doing?
Well, you know, for me, I think I just have that A personality. Well, you can see in the background, it's like my house. Everything has a spot. Everything's always perfect. And I opened my first book, His Majesty the Queen, by saying organization is the key to success. So I can't even work on a project till the house is perfect. The yard is perfect. I can't even sleep at night unless everything is hung up in my closet. But when everything is perfect, I could sit down and write that book. I could sit down and do a monologue. I could be creative and put music together that will work for a certain character. But everything around me has to be organized first, and then I could concentrate on that. Now, that's a hindrance because it's such a hard level to achieve, but it's also very rewarding because the end product, when I finally release it, is usually spectacular. And not because of me, because of these great people that I make sure I push to get that greatness out of them.
Now, I know a lot of the shows and a lot of the performances that you've been involved in over the years are of a very grand scale. But I understand that you also are doing some little more intimate things right now, including a new drag brunch.
Yes, DW Bistro, which is a very hip, trendy, like it's where everybody's on their phones, you know, at lunchtime. It's the power lunch place. I do a brunch there. I think it's like once a month, and it's DW Bistro, where I take a handful of drag queens, female impersonators, again, whatever you want, whatever they want to be called, and we do a show. So I get to do my legend show where everybody's live, recreating superstars. And then I get to do my drag show where we do our lip sync and do all that. And then I will be going on tour. I always do a tour once a year in Florida, which I love that audience. And then I'll play little theaters and nightclubs in Vegas with the drag queens to be able to keep the divas going. So it's kind of a lot. I enjoy doing legends more because I'm just a worker there. So I'm the star of the show, but it's not like I don't have a dancer call me, I stubbed my toe today, or Cher telling me I forgot my wig at home, or I don't have to babysit 35 people that are on my payroll every night and then worry about me last. I get to worry about me first in that show. I get to do that show and yet still have the smaller versions of the drag shows that I do to keep it in my heart and get that whatever necessity to do it out and that release. So it's a lot of fun to be able to have the balance of both.
Now, since your early days in Atlantic City, your primary character that you represent and portray has been Joan Rivers.
Right.
And you've done that for quite a number of years. If I'm not mistaken, you retired that character a couple of years ago. And have you now brought her back, or?
I brought it back because she only retired for 2 months because the minute I did Legends for like 6 months and it was going to be my last run with Joan Rivers. But then 2 weeks later, they asked me back. So literally by the time I went back into the show, it was like a month later. So I unretired Joan. And I don't want to sound like Cher, where it's every week I'm retiring another farewell tour. So Joan will always be my character when I'm doing Legends, because it's a live recreation of Legends. And when I do drag, I like to do myself. I created a femme fatale character that's me, the way RuPaul is RuPaul and Jimmy James is Jimmy James. He also does Marilyn. He does voices of everybody else, but he's still Jimmy James. I enjoy doing Frank Marino more than I enjoyed Joan Rivers, but I love Joan Rivers. I just enjoy doing my stuff more. Why? Because then I can wear whatever I want. The hairstyles can be whatever they want to be. It doesn't have to fit in a box of imitating somebody.
Right. And I have seen some clips of that diva, and striking the costumes,
That's
whole presence,
costumes. Yeah,
it's amazing. And I know with Joan Rivers had some great costumes, but I don't think she was nearly as flamboyant as you might like for a Vegas show sometimes.
Right, and I did love the fact though that she was like the chief of the fashion police with her shows and all that stuff. So it really made sense with her being a fashion icon and us changing the costume so many times in the show. I'll tell you a funny thing. I did the Joan Rivers show like 25 years ago when she had a daytime show, the afternoon talk show. And I was on with a couple of other Joan Rivers impersonators. And she says to me, it came full circle. I understand you impersonate me. You're making a living impersonating me. What would you do if I passed away? And we were like, oh my God. But I remember one of my friends saying, oh my God, don't say that. And I say, well, I would just join Legends at concert. So the audience started laughing. But at that time, Legends at concert was only dead legends, right? Because you were a legend if you passed and you stayed a star. But then the term living legends came about, and that's what legends, that you could be any big celebrity or superstar in Legends now. So it doesn't have to be a dead person, although Joan would fit now. But I'm just saying, ironically, 25 years later, I ended up being in the Legends show. So that's, you know, really strange to comprehend.
So since you focus so much of your career on Joan Rivers, do you have a favorite Joan Rivers story that you like to tell? Or
I think I was destined to do Joan Rivers because I never ran into somebody by mistake so many times. I remember when I was just working nightclubs, I ran into Joan Rivers. She was doing like the 5 o'clock news in New York, and I was walking in Manhattan, bumped right into her. But I knew her from meeting her in Atlantic City. Whether she remembered me or not, I don't know, but she acted like she did. So I saw her there. Then after I got a little bit of notoriety in Las Vegas, I don't know if you know this, but in 86, Joan Rivers sued me for $5 million for impersonating her. So we came full circle. I ended up meeting her in the dressing room, suing me when I got to Las Vegas because it was a little too close for comfort, making up, going on a talk show saying if she passed, I'd go to Legends of Concert. But I got it while we were in this midst of a lawsuit, and everybody thought it was like a publicity stunt because I had the cover of People magazine and The Inquirer, and I had my 15 minutes of major fame. And right in the middle of it, I get on the airplane, and it was TWA, just so you know how long ago. TWA, and the two seats in first class is like the two big seats, and you're really close. I remember turning around, and all of a sudden, I had the window seat, and Joan had the aisle seat. And her assistant, Dorothy, had the next aisle seat. And I was like, oh, my God. So from New York to Vegas, a 5-hour flight, I got to sit next to Joan Rivers in the middle of a lawsuit, which she and I both made it very comfortable for each other, but it was very strange. So that's probably my best Joan Rivers story.
Now, I understand that you also had Bob Mackie do some of your costuming for you. He did costumes for Cher, of course, and quite a number of other celebrities, but he did some for Joan too, didn't he?
Yes, he did Joan's gowns for her nightclub act. And I got to say, I got even a better story about Bob Mackie. So I go to Provincetown, and they have like all the little guest house, right? And so I was a snot-nosed little drag queen, you can imagine, right? And I brought all this Louis Vuitton luggage thinking who I was, right? And we get to this guest house and I plop all this luggage down. And they're like, there's no bellhop. And I'm like, so I have to carry these up the stairs now, right? So Then I start looking for an elevator. There's no elevator. So I literally had to lift them and carry them up the stairs now. So I get this all done. I get all my luggage because I had every piece from big to little. And I remember just being exhausted. And my boyfriend sits on the bed and I draw the drapes and then I shut them really quick. And he's like, what is the matter? I go, you're going to die. He's like, what? I go, Bob Mackie is sharing the balcony with us. There was two like penthouses on the top, which shared this wraparound balcony. So when I see Bob Mackie there, imagine being a drag queen. This is a drag queen's dream. Drawing your drapes and Bob Mackie's on your patio. I basically handcuffed the man to the fence and had the next 3 or 4 days with him under my lock and key. But he was very, very nice to me. I had some of my program books with me that had all the gowns that I actually had store-bought from him that, you know, like you can get in high-end stores like Neiman Marcus or what have you. But since I got to know him, then he started making me a lot of the gowns for the show. So it was just a very weird coincidence that actually ended up being really rewarding.
After you built up that friendship, did he also start making some Frank Marino attire? Are there some custom Bob Mackie?
For myself?
Or, yes.
As a man? No. I'll be honest with you. He's way too expensive for me to waste it if I'm not going to make money off of it on stage.
So speaking of your Frank Marino side, even going way back, there have been videos of your house in Las Vegas from years ago that I've seen kind of on that Cribs concept where somebody comes in and kind of walks through.
Yeah.
And it was pretty extravagant then. But I understand you've recently done a major remodel. What was it, about 5 or 6 years ago?
Yes.
And
it has a,
and this is a new house. I mean, not the same house that you bought 35 years ago, but it looks absolutely stunning. Is this something that as a younger man, you always had envisioned in your head to have this kind of fabulous, personalized mansion of a house?
Yeah. You know, some people are into cars. Some people are into whatever it is you could collect. I always wanted to decorate a very big home. So I do. We have a 15,000 square foot house now, which is it's huge. And it has like a movie theater, which a lot of houses have a movie theater. But it has a I have a hair salon in the house, all white and crystal. I have a wrapping room like Candy Spelling. Like that's where I got the idea from. And crazy little things like that in the house that I need for what I do. So it's very custom made for me and my partner, Alex. So he's got all his stuff in his offices that is very masculine. And I like the more like happy things like Disney stuff like that. So you can probably even see in the background, like I have a red kitchen, but I have like the villains cookie jars from Disney. So it's a very, it's a formal home, but it's also very whimsical. So it's a really fun feeling. I actually lost 3 decorators and 3 contractors on this project because decorators would come in and tell me, you can't put this with that. And I'd be like, you can do whatever you want. It's for me to live there. It's not for somebody else to live there.
Right.
So let's do it. And for that reason, they wanted to execute their ideas. So they could go decorate their own house. I ended up, you know, really decorating it myself, if you want to say.
And it's fabulous. I love the red kitchen and the red den. It's just, it's just striking. It's so expressive and it's so different. It's not, you know, the typical beechwood cabinets with the little, you know, frames around them and the brass handles. It looks so sharp. And of course I've seen other pictures in your home. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I think what was good was I was living in this house in my head for so long. So before I got the house, I went and designed a home. And the day we were breaking ground, the realtor said, can I take you to one more? I'm like, it's never going to be good. Why are we wasting our time? But I loved it. We walked in. Alex walked in and walked out, my partner. I walked in and said, wait, I think we could do something here. So it looked like a mountain lodge married the Palace of Versailles when they had it. It was like wood and marble. And I was like, this doesn't match. You got to go one or the other. I gutted the house. When I say to the ground, you could walk through the walls. I was so scared because this isn't my expertise, right? And I'm like, oh my God, is it ever going to come together? And it did, and it came together great because it took 2 years to renovate, but I was living in it in my head. And I was so careful to say, okay, what do I need in my bedroom? Close to the bathroom, I need a linen closet because you got to put the sheets and blankets. And then in the bathroom, what do I need? Well, I always use this, so I need whatever. And that's how I made sure everything I needed was in the house and that it would work for me and Alex.
Speaking of Alex, on the surface, when I've, been doing my research and learned a little bit about him, he seemed like a very kind of conservative, professional guy. Yeah. And then I saw the wedding proposal and I thought, obviously some of Frank has rubbed off on him because that was pretty much of a production. I mean, to do it in that fashion in front of that many people on a huge stage in Vegas, that was incredible. So has that an influence of you, or was that always kind of a hidden side of him that
I think it's always been a hidden side of him because he's a producer. He produces shows and he had Thunder from Down Under here in Vegas. He had American Storm, another strip show. I remember the MC from American Storm calling in sick and they were stuck at the last minute. And he just jumped on stage and MC'd the show. And I was like, so proud of him. But I was like, it was just so natural. Like, so he had it in there. He was dying to do it. It's like one of those Hollywood stories that you, like Shirley MacLaine got her job then when she was on Broadway and the star got sick and she had to jump in and she became a star. Same thing like with Alex. He just jumped on that stage and got his 5 minutes of fame, but he was very good at what he did. So yes, he's normally the more business type, more conservative. They don't let me sit in board meetings anymore. I will just tell him what I would like to have out of that meeting and he will go and do it. But because I would go like this to the board meeting, you know what I'm saying? And I wouldn't do that huggy kissy stuff. I'm like, we're here for a reason. What do we need done? How are we going to get it done? Because everything's like all hugs and kisses in any meeting. I actually, to be honest with you, I refuse to do meetings because I'm not going to drive to some conference table room. Do a meeting that if you wanted something, if you said to me, Frank, we wanted to change the menu of drinks in the showroom, you could call me and tell me. I don't need to sit there and go over it with you and go through 50 people to get it done. Just tell me what you want. I'll say yes. If I could physically do it, you ask me and I'll say yes back to you. So that's how it works. And he's more the corporate type. He'll sit there and have the power lunch and do that. To me, it wastes too much time. So I think opposites attract, and that's him and that's me.
Yeah, I was just sensing a little bit of channeling Joan Crawford there. I was envisioning that scene from the movie where she's in the Pepsi board meeting, and I picture it. You as her.
So. And you know what? Ironically, I never thought of that analogy before, but that's exactly what it is. I can't sit there and play the puppet when they're trying to play me to get something more out of me or take something away from me. You know what I'm saying? So yes, that's a great, I love it. I'm going to steal that and use it in the future. I'm going to tell you my personality. I don't know if you know of her, but I think you will, of Bethany Frankel.
Uh-huh.
The way she works and the way she speaks, I'm very forward, but I'm very loving too. Everything I do is out of love and caring. And if you could deal with me, the end product, I promise, will be good.
Now, you have referred to your home as the Showboy Mansion. Mm-hmm. I assume it's you that gave it that name, but I've seen it in the media, so it's stuck anyway. Do you still think that applies, or are you toning it down now that you're married and settled there with your husband of 20 plus years? And
well, I wanted to call it's a play on the Playboy Mansion.
Right.
I wanted it to be the Gay Boy Mansion. And Alex thought that was a little bit over the top. So he actually came up with the Showboy Mansion. And we agreed on that.
So for the most part, for 40 years, you've been out of the closet. But
yes.
I've seen pictures of your closet. Why would you ever come out of there?
You know what? Yes, I came at the closet, made sure everybody knows gay. But you are right. And I will say that closet is beautiful. The whole house was built around that closet. And I could live in that closet. It is, you're right. So that would be the only thing to make me go back in would be that closet.
I am absolutely awestruck. I have had friends give me grief because I have about, I don't know, 60 or 70 pairs of shoes. And some of them are a little bit extreme. And they're like, whoa, you know, what do you need that for? And then I saw your closet and I thought, there must be hundreds of pairs of shoes in there. And God knows how many, you know, glittery, sparkly, fancy blazers and everything else. It is absolutely amazing. It's almost as impressive as your drag wardrobe.
And I'll tell you, here's a secret nobody knows or nobody ever asked before, but I'll tell you, even with all that clothes, like if I ever got robbed, you're right, they would think Elton John lived here, okay? So it's all, because I feel why, like you said, like your clothes are very fancy too. Why bother putting clothes on your body and go out if it's not going to represent you and like have a statement, you know? You can walk around naked for that matter. So I do like the clothes to be over the top. And here's the trivia question. There's not one in that entire closet. There's not one piece of drag in this entire house. Everything's in my warehouse or in my dressing rooms. Nothing. There's not an eyelash here. There's nothing like that. So people are very, because they'll come over and they want to see like the drag. And I'm like, there is none here. And they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, this is where I live. That's what I do when I perform.
So have you given any thought? I know you mentioned about the politics of Vegas shows and how things are changing. Have you given any thought to what you might do when it comes time for you to retire or to step away from, you know, the big show stage and do something else? Have you given some thought?
I have because of COVID. I had the year off. I haven't gone back yet, but I'm going back May 27th to Legends. And if I love it like I loved it before, I'm not going to stop until they stop asking me to come back. Because at that point, you can't do anything. But I do want to do something else as well. And I don't know what it is. So I want to say I want to do something. And I've done everything I wanted to do. You know, we've done movies. We've done broadcasting. We've done modeling, we've done, you know, nightclub acts, CDs, DVDs, you name it, we've done, written books. So I've done everything I wanted to do. But I want to do something else, like outside of entertainment altogether. Like I want to be creative in a way that has nothing to do with show business. And I don't know what that is, but I do want to do something else as well as whatever I'm doing.
And we talked earlier about some of the iconic bars like Studio 54 and Limelight in New York, like the Copa in Fort Lauderdale. But those bars are pretty much disappearing. We're not seeing many of those anymore. But the rumor is that Lance Bass is taking over the old Rage space in Los Angeles. And depending on the story you listen to, it's either going to be physically the largest gay bar in the country or just the greatest gay bar in the country, not because of size, but because of fabulousness. What do you think about that?
I think if he does it, it will be the most famous and outrageous gay bar ever. I think if anybody can do it, he would be him and Adam Lambert. Would be the two people I think that could do it nowadays and people would flock. Those are both people that everybody adore. He's like a male Cher. Well, you never hear people saying anything bad about Cher at all. You know, you'll hear them say bad things about Madonna, Diana Ross, whatever, but never Cher. And I think he's like that. I think everybody loves him, embraces him. And if he did it in West Hollywood like that, a 100% success. I wouldn't care about pandemics. I wouldn't care about lack of people. He would pack that place every night. I think it would be the most ingenious thing he could do.
Yeah, and he's a great guy too. I'm sure you've met him. Mm-hmm. He and his husband, Michael, are just two of the nicest, sweetest guys that you'd ever want to meet. Sincere, honest. I met him in Atlanta for the second time I met him, at a marriage equality rally before the Supreme Court ruling. And he was traveling around the country, in support of marriage equality and doing all these appearances everywhere. Right. And, he didn't have to do that. I mean,
right.
And you're the same way. Celebrities do not have to go out of their way to raise hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars for a nonprofit, but you do, and you have. And that's very admirable. That's something that I always look at. And like Elton John, that's another one. Look at him. I mean, he's got, I know that you hold the record for the longest running headliner in Vegas, but Elton has got to be one of the longest running headliners on the planet. I mean, he's had a career that goes way back into the 60s at least, and he's still going.
And that's how they came up with the term living legends, because people like Elton John were able to succeed to such a level that you could have never even imagined before.
Right. And yet they still go out of their way to do good and to support the community. I know Elton's a big supporter of a lot of gay causes. And of course he has his own AIDS Foundation, which is an amazing thing. What special causes are you particularly attached to?
Well, over the years, I've literally done everything. I've worked with the blind. I've worked with the children. I've worked with the animals. Animals are a big one for me. So whenever anybody asked, I never said no. Anytime they asked, we have either performed, donated, given show tickets, some form of help. Right now, I'm the spokesperson for a nonprofit called Positively Kids, and they help out children with dentistry and schooling. And, it's like an off branch sort of where St. Jude's is medical. This is like after that, but also some medical. Because you don't realize after all that, then they're going to need, if there's no money there, they need all these other things that other people take for granted. And for that reason, the children and the animals are the number one for me. But I've done everything from cancer. I did a calendar for AMFAR, which I know Elton John was involved with Elizabeth Taylor at one point. So you do what you got to do. And Vegas is a very give and take place. So they've given me so much, you had to give back. And so I just directed myself of where I was at that point in my life to what I wanted to concern my efforts to. So I think at this point, we've really hit the gamut of everything.
So obviously you've been in Vegas for about 40 years. You're very well settled there. You've built your dream home. You have, a long-standing relationship with your husband. Everything seems to be all happy, and it seems like you've pretty much accomplished everything there. Is this going to be your forever home? Are you there for the long haul, or?
So here it is. It was fun to build. It was fun to decorate, and it was fun to move in. It is a bitch to upkeep, meaning every day something's wrong with something. There's so many air conditioners and so many, like, a funny story is buying a hose. Then I had to go out and count. There were 11 hoses, to get around. I was like, oh, so you can't just buy the one hose in front and one hose in back. So there's 11 hoses. And there was like, oh, God forbid you got to change your air filters, right? So there's 100 of those. And the batteries on the smoke alarms, every season. So it's just very hard. So Alex would be in heaven if I would, there's a beautiful high rise here called Queens Ridge. How fitting, right? would be extremely happy if we could just move into that. I'm not ready for that yet. I like to have a big yard and I like to have a home, but it is really tough. And I'm really at the point of, if I had to move, I know how difficult it is now. I wouldn't be able to take a lot of things that I love, but for that reason, I want to stay here as long as I can. But I did promise him in 13 years, because I'm 57, I said, when I'm 70, I promise you we could move into the other house. Just not right now.
So you might want to buy that one when you're around 68, so you have time to get it ready to move into.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know me, at this point, it would have to be altered and changed and rearranged.
So with your career in Vegas and traveling the country, you've learned a lot of things about the entertainment industry, not only from the performance side, but also from the management side, because, you know, the Divas is your show. You're at the top of that heap. Right. What advice would you offer for new entertainers, particularly ones that are in the gay and lesbian market, whether they're, you know, drag performers or they're live singers or whatever they're trying to do to break in? What advice would you give them so that they could possibly accomplish some of the things that you've accomplished?
I think because of the way the climate is out there and the way show business and business itself has been going, I think it'd be very difficult to get to a level of me or higher of a RuPaul level or, you know, wherever you want to go from that, because of the way people just want everything from you. But my advice would be never take the word no. And when I hire an assistant, that's the first thing I say. Never let somebody tell you no. If they say, sorry, we don't do this, figure out a way to try to get them to do it. Okay. I'm talking about a reservation for a restaurant or cutting the line somewhere or something like that. And then just don't listen to anybody that tells you can't do it. You know what I'm saying? If you could think it, you can do it. So just as long as it takes you, just keep trying. I have a great thing in my office. It's a basketball hoop and it says, you miss every shot you don't take. So you could take that shot and miss, but if you don't take it at all, you're definitely going to miss. So that's what it's saying. And that's also the advice that I really go by myself. If it's something you want bad enough, just fight till you get it. And most times you're going to get it.
Now, I just have to ask you, this basketball net that's in your office, is it covered in glitter and rhinestones?
You know what? I wish I could move this thing, and maybe I could. But I have a room in the house. Did you see the Tiffany room online?
There's a
room that's all done like Tiffany. It's got the drapes or the bow and everything like that. But I have a Tiffany basketball. You ready? And then we're on the airplane, and Shannon's sleeping. This is just a couple of months ago. And I'm like, get up. And he's like, what? They had a crystal basketball hoop. So I said, we could put this in the Tiffany room. And I'll put the basketball in it. And I do have a crystal basketball hoop. So it's funny you should ask.
Why am I not surprised?
Hey, I have a Louis Vuitton garbage can too. That threw a lot of people for a loop as well.
But you know, you've earned it. I mean, who else has a career like you do coming to Vegas as basically a teenager, you know, young adult, and staying there for almost four decades?
Yeah.
Doing the same.
Even I can't believe it. So I'll tell you that. Even I can't believe it. I'm very happy that I was able to do that because I just love doing what I do.
You know, I know there's other performers that have had their own legendary experiences in Vegas. The first one that comes to mind, of course, was Liberace, which, you know, when he shattered the salary record there and just became like, you know, this amazing one man show. And I see shades of him in you too, which I'm probably not the first time you've heard that either. With, you know, the little bit of extravagance and showiness and, you know.
The love for Christmas. I didn't talk about that, but that's what we also have in common.
And your dog.
Yes, the dog. Can I tell you something? He was one of the first celebrities I met in Las Vegas. And throughout all the stories and what have you in the movies, this was one of the nicest people you ever want to meet. He would literally say, I would call him, he would be at Caesars and I'd say, we're coming over now. He's like, you don't even have to call, just come walking backstage. And I'm like, okay, well now I know why, because I was young and he was probably, you know, wanting to be a friend, but he was extremely, extremely nice. And the way we first met was I had some coats done before I became this animal activist. I had some coats done at this furrier that made all those famous fur coats for him. The one with the diamond Liberace down it and the white furs. And actually she let me try them on. And then one time I went in there and he was there and she told him, she goes, I let Frank try on your coat. And he was like, that's okay. So what I'm trying to say is just the nicest guy, not pretentious at all, just a sweetheart.
Yeah. And, you know, I've met some celebrities at various events and different functions. And in general, that has been my experience. If you're meeting them on safe ground, in other words, you're not stalking them at a premiere of some show, but you're at their show or at a benefit they're hosting, or, you know, a dinner that they've been invited to, they're generally nice people, you know, friendly and warm.
Most of them.
Yes, there's a few.
There's a couple. I have my list. I won't tell you, but some are very obnoxious.
But Elton was the same way with me. Elton was extremely accommodating and friendly. And
you would think he could go either way, because right. I did see, Tantrums and Tiaras. I was like, oh, please don't yell while I'm in there. I'll die. But he was just like you said, my mother was with me when I met him, and he was like, come in, Mom. And his thing at Caesars, his dressing room looked like an apartment, like a house. And we were in like the kitchen den area and have some drinks, da, da, da. Very, very nice man. Very, very nice.
Yeah, he was, I met him backstage. Well, for the third or fourth time I met him, but I was backstage at his concert in Albuquerque about, I don't know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I had a friend with me. He was my guest at the concert. And when we went backstage, and Elton and I took some pictures for a fundraising project I was doing for his AIDS foundation. Mm-hmm. And then my friend is standing over in the corner, and Elton yells over after we're done, you know, he says, does your friend want to be in a picture? And grabs him and drags him over and takes a bunch of pictures with him, you know, just.
And that's very nice, because I know some people that, Rosie O'Donnell, that won't take pictures with anybody. And I'm like, what would you do without these fans? They're the ones that make you famous. And I thought it was, I'll tell you the honest story about that. We were going on a plane to do Sally, Jesse, Raphael. Remember the red glasses?
I do.
And Rosie, I'm always sitting next to somebody. Rosie is right next to us. She's like, hey, Frank. Because you know where I had Lacage on the bottom was the improv. So she would play the improv quite often, and I would get to see her. And to me, she was just Rosie, my friend who became famous. And to my boyfriend, she was Betty Rubble from the Flintstone movie. So he was all excited. And the fact that she wouldn't take a photograph with him and told me next time she's in town, she would. And then I would call her and she wouldn't again. I just thought that was really cold. And it's why would somebody have to be like that? To him, it would have meant the world. And to her, it would have been 2 seconds out of her day.
Right.
But, you know, everybody has their choices for their reasons. And I just did. Meanwhile, she's on TV at the time being the queen of nice, not in real life. But we soon found out that that wasn't the true story years to come.
Yeah, it's not always what it appears to be, which is the whole basis of your career.
Right. If you ever do another series called Calling Celebrities Out, call me, please. I'll be more than happy to come on.
No.
I'll tell you who all the nice ones are and the mean ones are. You know who was a sweetheart and she just passed away? Was my very good friend, Mary Wilson from the Supremes. I was talking to her the day she passed, and that was just the sweetest, classiest lady. I'm a huge Diana Ross fan. And then I love the Supremes as well. But becoming friends with Mary and having her be so sweet. Like another one is Priscilla Presley in Vegas. I got to meet her many times. Another person is just so, 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 so sweet. And it's such a relief when you see these superstars or super names that are just so relatable and kind to you. And then there are others that not so much.
And I'm sure you'll have an opportunity to meet quite a few more of them as you continue your career in Vegas. It seems like every year you get a little bit more famous and a little bit more well-known.
And you know what it is? I just think the longer you're in the business, the longer you do different things. Like I got to open for Bette Midler when Obama was running, and they just asked me to open for Cher, but it was 8 a.m. So I didn't do it, but I did have my friend Eddie Edwards, who I know you interviewed a few weeks ago. I had him he was in town. And I'm like, please, can you do this? And he's like, oh my God, yes, I'd love to. And so that was a lot of fun, but I wasn't getting a drag at 8 a.m. for anybody. So I love me some Cher, as I told you, but I have to see her afternoon. Otherwise, it's not happening.
Yeah, and that, you know, Bette Midler's name comes up all the time.
Yeah.
I've been researching, obviously, the history of the gay bar industry and talking to a lot of people who have long-running experience. And I cannot tell you, you know, how many times Bette Midler's name has come up with some sort of a positive message, or, yeah, she inspired me to do this, or she introduced me to somebody that made my career move forward. And in fact, on Wednesday, in 4 or 5 days from now, whatever, I'll be interviewing Bruce Valanche.
Also great.
Who, you know, basically helped launch Bette Midler into her career by writing material for her when she was performing in bathhouses. So,
And you know, still to today, because I saw him at her concert and he was watching the show and he goes, every night I write something different for her because her fans come back so often that he just gives her timely, like daily timely things to talk about.
Well, I think he's gotten that experience from working on the Oscars so many years, because at the Oscars, you have to keep it fresh. And there are things that happen, you know, days before the ceremony or even at the ceremony that you want to capitalize on while it's still fresh. And so,
when you interview him next week, please make sure you say I said hello and that I love him to death.
I will do that. I will definitely do that. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about your career and your experience with gay bars and kind of letting us get to know you a little bit better from a side other than, you know, what the commercial media talks about. Is there anything else you'd like to add that you'd like to tell our audience about?
If anybody wants to come and see our show, you're going to be in Vegas, please just check my social media. My website's frankmarino.com. My Instagram is @thequeenofvegas. My Facebook's Frank Marino, Frank Marino's Divas, and Frank Marino fan page. I would love it if you guys could follow me because we have a lot of fun stuff, not only about me, but all the great cast members we've had over the years and who we have presently today, and just a lot of fun. So I would love to keep in touch with a lot of you guys. This was great going down memory lane. It just brought back a lot of memories of really happy times. So I want to say thank you for you. And let me say thank you to everybody out there that has seen Lacage or Divas or Legends over the years. If it wasn't for you guys, I wouldn't be who I am. So thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity.
And that concludes another segment of the Gay Bar Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gaybarchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.